Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We are coming to the end of Krishna's pastimes in the 10th canto. Today we'll read chapter 23, page 326. And this again is, we're going back a bit. So we went ahead a bit yesterday. Thank you, Gopal Prabhu. And this gives us a chance to hear some learned commentary from Akendra Prabhu this morning. So this is a rather long chapter. And you recall it begins with Krishna in his palace in Dwarka being requested to be in two places at once, both at the Rajasuya sacrifice of the Pandavas and also to free the jailed kings. Now, where did we see Jarasandha before, this man who has jailed the kings? Yes, he attacked Dwarka. You remember, what was his relation to Krishna's earlier pastimes in Mathura? Not Dwarka, I'm sorry, he attacked Mathura. What was his relation to Krishna's Mathura pastimes? Father-in-law of Kamsa, exactly. So when Krishna killed Kamsa, his Jarasandha's daughters, Asti and Prapti, became widows. And so Jarasandha was very mad at Krishna. So he attacked Mathura. And you remember, Krishna, with just a handful of men, killed all of his soldiers. And then he released Jarasandha so he would get another army and bring it back so he could kill those soldiers also. Because what was Krishna's purpose in incarnating? To relieve the burden of the earth, unnecessary military phalanxes. Right. So Jarasandha was very helpful in that regard. How many times did he attack? 17 times, and every time he was defeated, and every time he'd go back and his ministers would say, it was just a bad day. Try again. So, finally, the 18th time, what happened? Kaliyavana was attacking from the other direction. And so, this time, Jarasandha was able to what? What was he able to do to Krishna? Chased him, yes. He got Krishna to run away. And Krishna, what did Krishna, where did Krishna run? To the mountain. And then what did Jarasandha do? He burned the mountain. And what did Krishna and Balaram do? They jumped off the top, even though it was 87 miles high. No, it was the second time. They attacked almost simultaneously. So Kaliyavana chased after Krishna, and then Muchukunda killed him. Krishna came back and killed Kaliyavana's army, and then dealt with Muchukunda by running away. Not Muchukunda, by Jarasandha. Okay. So now Jarasandha, after that, has kidnapped 20,000 kings, and obviously there were a lot of kingdoms in those days, and he had them all in prison. They sent a messenger, please, Krishna, please help us. So now Krishna is going to deal with this request by asking Uddhava for advice. So here's Uddhava's response. Chapter 23, the Pandavas, Uddhava's answer. Evaluating both the king's and Narada's requests, Uddhava said, my lord, as saintly Narada suggests, you must assist the Pandavas by going there yourself, yet you must also save the kings, beseeching you for help. To hold the special sacrifice, the Pandavas desire, a monarch must defeat all foes. It's utterly required. Jarasandha stands in the way of that prerequisite, and thus you cannot help the Pandavas, at least not yet. Jarasandha is powerful and tricky to defeat. He far exceeds 10,000 giant elephants in strength. Since Bhima is the only man equivalent in might, he could destroy the scoundrel if we set the proper fight. Jarasandha will lose if he is battled hand to hand, but not if he brings forth the mighty army he commands. If Bhima goes in Brahman's clothes and begs for charity, Jarasandha will grant his wish, whatever it may be. In charity, Jarasandha can't bear to be outdone, so Bhima simply needs to beg to fight him one-on-one. He then can kill Jarasandha. And now, my lord, for you, I must say all these warriors, kings, and gods are just your tools. The wives of these imprisoned kings keep faith in you and pray when their young children ask them why their fathers went away. Like they and we, The gopis see your great ability, for you saved Sita and your parents from captivity. Not only will Jarasandha's demise make all inspired, the Pandavas can hold the sacrifice that they desire. Though younger Yadu princes would have issued war commands, both Krishna and the Yadu elders backed Uddhava's plan. Sage Narada was pleased with this and promptly took his leave, and Krishna told the messenger the kings would be relieved. He sent the man to tell the kings about his rescue plan so they could wait and tolerate the misery at hand. Greeting Krishna. Lord Krishna then took sanction from his father to proceed. His servants made arrangements for his wives and children's needs, for they were keen to be a part of Krishna's entourage and see the city of the sons of Pandu Maharaj. Lord Krishna's golden chariot displayed Garuda's sign. His soldiers marched around him and his family behind. As music played and men paraded, other burly men conveyed his wives and children on their golden palanquins. Alongside were the serving maids on camels, carts, and steeds, with blankets, tents, and other things the travelers would need. The soldiers' swords and armor shone. In all, the great display appeared to be an ocean full of undulating waves. Lord Krishna's party traveled over rivers, fields, and hills. On nearing Indraprastha, which the gods had helped to build, the Lord observed a multitude of ministers and priests surrounding Yudhisthira, who was appearing very pleased. While music played and Brahmins chanted hymns, King Yudhisthira received the person whom his thoughts had constantly revered. As senses gain awareness when a sleeping man revives, the Pandavas felt Krishna had restored their very lives. King Yudhisthira embraced the Lord again and yet again, forgetting in his ecstasy this planet of chagrin. Then Bhima, laughing as he cried, embraced his dearest Lord. Arjuna and the twins were next, their teardrops also poured. The Lord bowed down before the priests and elders of the clan as singers, dancers, jesters, and narrators all began to glorify Lord Krishna with their own respective skills. As peals of music sounded, everyone was pleased and thrilled. Surrounded by his well-wishers and relatives, the Lord came into Indraprastha, where his name was much adored. The city roads, adorned with flags and sprinkled with perfume, were lined by homes with welcome lamps that shone in every room. Each building had a golden dome atop a silver base. The citizens were finely dressed and blessed with sandal paste. As Krishna savored Indraprastha, women rushed to see, abandoning their homes and mates with great alacrity. The royal road was crowded, so the women, clothes askew, ascended to the rooftops to see what the Lord would do. As heartfelt, broadly smiling glances crossed each lovely face, they showered flowers on him and within felt his embrace. Observing Krishna's wives, who looked like stars around the moon, the women cried, "What have they done to win this matchless boon of Krishna's generous smiles and loving, playful, sidelong glance?" Lord Krishna, meanwhile, took in many gifts as he advanced. The royal household members rushed to their beloved guest and brought him to the palace to fulfill the queen's request. Queen Kunti rose and hugged the Lord. King Yudhisthira, her son, forgot in all his bliss how rites of greeting should be done. Lord Krishna bowed before Queen Kunti and the many wives of other family elders who had loved him all their lives. His younger sister, Subhadra, and Draupadi bowed down to Krishna and his escorts, several wives of great renown. As Draupadi received the wives with garlands, gems, and clothes, King Yudhisthira arranged for royal dining and repose. Lord Krishna's massive entourage enjoyed with each new day some method of reception in a fresh and different way. Talks with Yudhisthira. The Pandavas found Krishna so addictive and sublime, they soon convinced the Lord to stay among them for some time. So after sharing talks of quests and joyful fellowship, Lord Krishna and the king discussed the reason for his trip. One day in the assembly hall, surrounded by a group of sages, business magnates, priests, and military troops, King Yudhisthira addressed the Lord as brothers, gurus, friends, and elder family members all sat down and listened in. "Although we have no need for property, gold, or mansions, I long to worship your auspicious divine expansions, the gods themselves, to show the world they depend upon you. Bless us, my Lord, that our endeavor may have some value." Your devotees, who have consistently sung your praises, escape this mortal life in all of its painful phases. Still, they achieve enough material satisfaction to far surpass the godless souls in the mode of passion. So let the world observe the power of pure devotion and see the emptiness of tedious self-promotion. You have no favorites, for all souls are your dependents, yet you prefer your devotees in complete transcendence. The Lord replied, "Your thoughts are perfect, noble, and worthwhile. You've shown divine and secular indeed can reconcile. The sages, gods, and ancestors will all be satisfied if you perform this monumental sacrifice worldwide. You must establish taxes and make every king enroll until the very earth itself is under your control. Your brothers will assist you by collecting ample wealth, for they were born of mighty gods, O king. As for yourself, your self-control is so complete, you've even conquered me by using all your senses in my service constantly. No person lacking sense control, be he a god or king, can conquer my devotee with his riches, fame, or strength." The generous Jarasandha. On hearing this, King Yudhisthira felt thoroughly empowered. His face lit up as if it were a blooming lotus flower. To eastern lands he ordered Bhima. Then the king sent forth Nakula west, Sahadev south, and Dhananjaya north. The brothers told the kings they met of Yudhisthira's intent to hold the Rajasuya sacrifice, which clearly meant the kings would either pay a tax or fight with Yudhisthira. So every king paid taxes out of love, respect, or fear. Jarasandha alone refused King Yudhisthira's demand. So Krishna told the king about Uddhava's clever plan. Thus Krishna, Bhima, and Arjuna, veiled in Brahman's dress, approached Jarasandha's domain and tendered this request. "Great king, you're famed for giving needy guests what they require. We wish all good upon you. Kindly give us what we desire. When begging from the generous, fulfillment is assured, for nothing is so precious that its loss can't be endured. A great soul has no enemy. He sees all as the same. He overcomes all selfishness and wins eternal fame. For instance, Bali gave the universe in charity, and Shibi gave his very flesh to set a pigeon free." Jarasandha took notice that the voices of these guests were more like those that grant, not those that issue such requests. He saw their muscled arms showed marks of bowstrings, and what's more, he had a hazy feeling he had seen them all before. Jarasandha thought, "Surely these are Kshatriyas disguised as Brahmin beggars. Still, a great man makes no alibis. I too shall gain King Bali's fame by giving of myself to satisfy these Brahmins, though they're clearly someone else." Decisively, Jarasandha observed his guests and said, "I'll give you what you ask for, even if it's my own head." Lord Krishna, Bhima, and Arjuna, very satisfied, acknowledged his munificence. Lord Krishna then replied, "We ask you for a duel. We are princes. Let us fight. That's all we ask. Here's Bhima with Arjuna on his right, and I am their maternal cousin Krishna. We have met a few times on the battlefield before. Did you forget?" Jarasandha laughed loudly and replied, "All right, you fools. You could have had my head. Now you've gained nothing by this ruse. But Krishna, you have run from me. No second chance for you. And Arjuna, you're weak. But Bhima, yes, I think you'll do." Bhima battles Jarasandha. With this, Jarasandha presented Bhima with a mace and went off with his rival to a distant rural place. The two began to strike each other. Thoroughly enraged, they circled left and right as actors dance upon a stage. Like tusks of dueling elephants, their maces would collide. It sounded like a thunderstorm refusing to subside. So strong were both combatants that, as blow by blow was thrown, they smashed their wooden clubs to bits against each other's bones. Their clubs thus ruined, Bhima and Jarasandha began to pound each other with their fists and battle hand to hand. The two were matched in stamina, in training, and in might, and thus for 27 days they carried on the fight. Jarasandha had secrets in his past that Krishna knew. It seems that he was stillborn with his body split in two. An evil witch procured the pieces, joined them into one, and raised him as her powerful but evil-hearted son. Since Bhima wasn't winning, Krishna showed him what to do by picking up a supple branch and ripping it in two. So Bhima tripped Jarasandha and, standing on his calf, pulled strongly on his other leg and ripped him right in half. Jarasandha's companion saw his two halves had been breached, with half a torso, throat, and face, one leg and one arm each. They cried in lamentation as Lord Krishna tightly hugged the mighty warrior Bhima, who had finally killed the thug. The Lord then crowned Jarasandha's respected elder son as ruler of his father's land. The coronation done, Lord Krishna freed the 20,000 long imprisoned kings, just as he kindly liberates conditioned living beings. Krishna frees the kings. The kings emerged from prison looking soiled and poorly dressed. Their bodies looked emaciated, pale, and greatly stressed. They saw the Lord in yellow silks and skin of monsoon blue, his smiling face adorned with lotus eyes of pinkish hue. The Lord displayed his four-armed form, and in his lotus hands a conch shell, lotus, disc, and club awaited his command. His gorgeous gems and flowers made the Lord appear so sweet the kings forgot their senses as they bowed and touched his feet. To see the Lord was ecstasy. The kings at once forgot the weariness of prison, having gained what they had sought. The master of the senses stood before them, then and there. They joined their palms, stood up as one, and thankfully declared, "O Lord, this ghastly world has made us thoroughly depressed. We bow to you who crushes a submissive soul's distress. We do not blame Jarasandha. Our torment was your grace to rid us of illusions that attach us to this place. As childish men seek water from mirages in the sand, a fool reveres illusions that keep slipping through his hand. Forgetting you and chasing wealth, we fought without regard for anybody else. Dear Lord, your lesson has been hard. Mirages such as kingdoms shall no longer swindle us to prostitute our bodies as they dwindle into dust. We'll not hear heaven's tantalizing song, however sweet. Our pride is gone. We only long to touch your lotus feet. Please tell us how to think of you as we endure our fate of death and birth upon this earth we can't evacuate. O son of Vasudeva, we bow to you repeatedly, for you destroy the pain of your surrendered devotee." When all the kings had finished praising Krishna, he replied, "I promise, my dear kings, you shall be always satisfied by serving me unswervingly, as each of you aspires, and shedding the psychosis of material desires." Enamored with materialism, monarchs of the past, Haihaya, Vena, Ravana, and others of their caste, were ruined. Friends, your bodies and their trimmings start and end. As ruler, simply worship me, as scriptures recommend. So live your lives, have children, feel your pleasure and distress, while keeping me the focus of your inner consciousness. Detached from things material, self-satisfied and firm, eventually you'll reach my kingdom, never to return. Completing his instructions, Krishna sent a retinue of servants who could help the scruffy kings become renewed. Jarasandha's successor, as the Vedic texts insist, revered the king with garlands, gems, and many other gifts. Lord Krishna then arranged to feed the kings a dazzling feast, including first-class betel nuts and other royal treats. Thus honored by Lord Krishna, all the kings were purified and glowed like brilliant stars and moons when monsoons cleansed the sky. The Lord then called for chariots adorned with jewels and gold and sent the kings back home to the domains they used to hold. The grateful kings, recalling how Lord Krishna saved their lives, exalted him and acted on his words when they arrived. The Rajasuya Sacrifice. The Lord took worship from Jarasandha's respectful son and rode off with his friends, their work for Yudhisthira all done. When they reached Indraprastha, they blew conch shells to announce their friends had been established and their enemies denounced. The residents adored the sound, as did King Yudhisthira, who listened as his brothers and the Lord assuaged his fear. When he learned that the kings were free and all that had occurred, King Yudhisthira shed tears of love and couldn't say a word. At last the king addressed the Lord with obvious delight. Your precious orders grace the heads of all who are upright, including gurus of this world and heaven's every god. Yet you accept my orders as a part of your facade. Just as the sun is constant, though it seems to rise and fall, your role-play doesn't alter your supremacy at all. Your attitude of service also graces devotees who, unlike brutes and animals, assist humanity. His gratitude expressed, the king prepared the sacrifice by waiting for the proper time and seeking the advice of famous Vedic priests and sages. Soon he felt informed of how the Rajasuya sacrifice should be performed. These sages were invited, as were Dhritarashtra's clan, Duryodhana, Vidura, and the kings of many lands. The Vaishyas and the Shudras joined the Kshatriyas and priests by each bringing to the sacrifice a certain expertise. According to the principles the Vedic texts espouse, the Brahmins tilled the sacrificial ground with golden plows. Utensils for the sacrifice were also made of gold. Among the guests, the gods, well-dressed, flew in to join the fold. Lords Indra, Shiva, and Brahma were thoroughly aware, as were celestial beings who arrived from everywhere, that devotees of Krishna, like King Yudhisthira, are blessed with opulence akin to what the gods themselves possess. The gods, who once performed the Rajasuya sacrifice, observed King Yudhisthira's performance, perfect and precise. The priests were like the gods themselves, and Yudhisthira began to worship them according to the sacrificial plan. Shishupal speaks. After that, all present were to choose among the guests the person most deserving to be honored as the best. So many great exalted sages, gods, and saints were there. The choice was hard. At last, Sahadev stood up and declared, Lord Krishna is the person this assembly should select. He is the sacrifice itself in each and all respects. The gods, the sacred place, and all these opulent supplies come only from Lord Krishna. Does this come as a surprise? Relying solely on himself, Lord Krishna manifests the whole cosmic creation. Then he puts it all to rest. All kinds of yoga, sacrifice, and other Vedic rites aim only for his pleasure. Therefore, choosing him is right. He generates the duties of this world, so by his grace, religion, business, pleasure, and release are taking place. By honoring Lord Krishna first, we're honoring ourselves, for he, the soul of all, views nothing separate from himself. The saintly persons present cried out, Excellent indeed! King Yudhisthira took notice and wholeheartedly agreed. He lovingly bathed Krishna's feet, as ritual decrees, and sprinkled all with foot wash, making all but one feel pleased. That water purifies the world. The king, in ecstasy, gave Krishna gifts of gems and silk. He couldn't even see, for tears of love for Krishna filled the monarch's royal eyes. The congregation bowed as flowers showered from the sky. Amid this scene of bliss stood Shishupal, enraged and red. He thrashed his arms to gain attention, turned and boldly said, It seems the devastating force of time is on display when elders let a simple child influence them this way. O leaders of the sacrifice, you surely know who's best for being honored. Why accept what Sahadev suggests? Will you neglect the great exalted sages that I see in favor of a cowherd who disgraced his family? Why should this quirky, cunning person, suited for no caste, be given any adulation? Be it first or last. It seems as if a crow has wandered in the sacrifice to eat the holy sacrificial cakes of ghee and rice. The Yadus left the holy lands to live within the sea, degrading and manipulating others constantly. These relatives of Krishna have been ostracized and cursed. How can this great assembly choose to worship Krishna first? Just as a mighty lion might ignore a jackal's cries, Lord Krishna waited silently as Shishupal spoke lies. The insults, though, offended the most learned and devout, who covered up their ears, stood up, and angrily walked out. By listening complacently while Krishna is defamed, a person loses all religious merit he has gained. So some departed when they heard what Shishupal had said, while others, like the Pandavas, prepared to smash his head. Undaunted, Shishupal pulled out his vaunted shield and sword, deriding the devoted souls who sided with the Lord. As Shishupal was trying to despoil the sacrifice, Lord Krishna's razor disc removed his head in one clean slice. With this great feat, the crowd released a huge, unprompted roar. While Shishupal's supporters deftly tiptoed out the door. A self-effulgent light rose out of Shishupal just then and entered Krishna, much as earthbound meteors descend. For three successive lifetimes, Shishupal despised the Lord. Because of his obsession, he at last gained this reward. He once had guarded Vishnu's gates, but later took a curse. He had to bear three evil births before it was reversed. King Yudhisthira completed the momentous sacrifice by giving gifts and bathing in accord with Vedic rites. The king knew well that Krishna was the cause of his success, and Krishna stayed there with the king, obeying his request. The king appeared like Indra as his inner luster blazed. The honored gods and sages left him, singing Krishna's praise. At last the hour came for Krishna also to take leave, and Yudhisthira permitted it, though most reluctantly. Except for Duryodhana, the sinner, everyone was pleased. He couldn't bear the happiness of Krishna's devotees. If you, however, speak about the death of Shishupal, effects of sin that cause chagrin will end for once and all. The concluding bath. He'd listened now for days, but Vishnurata wasn't tired. When Sukadev's last statement puzzled him, the king inquired, "If people love the sacrifice, O sage, as I just heard, then why was Duryodhana upset? Did something else occur?" The patient Sukadev replied, "His subjects all admired your grandfather, King Yudhisthira, and did what he desired. As Bhima ran the kitchen, Sahadev was there to greet the venerated guests, and then Lord Krishna washed their feet. The treasurer was Duryodhana. Nakula brought supplies. The elders went to Arjuna, and Karna supervised delivery of gifts. Queen Draupadi served out the meals, and everyone contributed. The mood was quite ideal. The sacrifice was finished with assistance from the staff, except for Yudhisthira's conclusive sacrificial bath. As drums were pounded, horns resounded, flutes and cymbals played, delighting gods above as lovely dancers turned and swayed. The kings, adorned in gold, felt bold, their armies right behind, proceeding to the Ganga, where the waters are divine. With infantry and cavalry and elephants as well, the many massive armies seemed to shake the earth itself. The ritual's officials, joined by other learned priests, recited Vedic mantras with delightful expertise. The residents of heaven, gods and sages looking on, rained flowers on the gathering below and sang along. The well-dressed men and women, wearing garlands, silks, and gems, began to sprinkle liquids on each other as a whim. The men soaked lovely courtesans with yogurt, oil, and scents. The courtesans, with glee, drenched several men in self-defense. Attracted by the fun, the queens of Yudhisthira came out and found themselves as targets in the friendly liquid bout. As Krishna, Bhima, Arjuna, and others splashed the queens, their shyly smiling faces bloomed, embellishing the scene. The queens had large syringes to squirt fluids at the men. So yellow-tinted liquids flew again and yet again. As dripping, clinging saris showed the forms of thighs and busts, the lesser men, observing, felt their minds inflamed with lust. King Yudhisthira, resplendent in the presence of his queens, was like the sacrifice itself among its small routines. Queen Draupadi joined Yudhisthira to hold the final rites. They bathed in Ganga's water to the demigods' delight. The citizens bathed also, for the Ganges waters cleanse effects of endless lifetimes full of countless dreadful sins. The king put on new garments and then honored all his guests by giving them fine jewelry and new expensive dress. The men wore turbans, waistcoats, gems, and all things debonair. The women sported earrings, golden belts, and perfect hair. The sages, gods, and other guests, both famous and unknown, were honored by King Yudhisthira and went back to their homes. As ordinary men cannot stop drinking something sweet, the guests could not stop praising Yudhisthira's amazing feat. The king himself felt separation's fierce impending pain, so he convinced Lord Krishna and some others to remain. Lord Krishna sent some leaders back to Dwaraka and stayed. King Yudhisthira thus finished his remarkable crusade to hold the Rajasuya sacrifice, a daunting task, and show how Krishna helps his devotees each time they ask. Duryodhana embarrassed. King Yudhisthira's success and riches rankled Duryodhana. His palace, for example, was resplendent far beyond the palace Duryodhana enjoyed, and Draupadi, as well, unsettled Duryodhana, who'd failed to win her for himself. Lord Krishna's many queens stayed on at Draupadi's request. Their charming gait and slender waists and kumkum-dusted breasts enhanced their lovely faces, which were framed in flowing hair. They beautified the palace as they wandered here and there. One day, as Yudhisthira held court with Krishna at his side, he seemed as rich as Indra, but without a trace of pride. Then Duryodhana, with royal crown, burst in his cousin's court, admonishing the doorkeepers with insolent retorts. The palace's designer, Maya Dhanava, had placed protective built-in features that intruders couldn't trace. Bewildered by these mystic hoaxes, Duryodhana mistook a pool to be a solid floor, for that was how it looked. When Duryodhana fell in the water, Bhima laughed aloud, along with all the women, kings, and others in the crowd. King Yudhisthira attempted to restrain this mockery, but Krishna smiled along and gave a nod approvingly. Disgraced and angry, Duryodhana got out and, looking down, stormed out of Indraprastha without uttering a sound. King Yudhisthira and other saints regretted all the mirth, but Krishna simply saw a burden rising from the earth. Akendra Prabhu.
Could everybody go to page 333? Vancha kalpatrubhyascha kripa sindhubhyeva cha patitanam bhavanibhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namaha. It's hard to say chronologically how much time all of these pastimes that you started reciting this morning would take up, but there's so many things that could be spoken about this. What struck me was on page 333, Krishna's freeing the kings that Jarasandha had imprisoned. In verses 51 through 54, the last two lines, they say, "We do not blame Jarasandha. Our torment was your grace to rid us of illusions that attach us to this place." I thought about that. And how, when we think of Krishna's grace or Krishna's mercy, we usually pray for that in different ways. At least I shamelessly pray to the Lord for good health, for financial security, and things like this. Yesterday I overheard someone saying here that, "Oh, the drudgery of material life, laundry and dishes." Here are these kings. Does it say how long they've been imprisoned? But from their description, it was a pretty long and awful time for all of them. And so, and they probably weren't even able to do laundry or wash dishes. They would have probably paid money to do laundry and wash dishes. But all of us have our conception of what we want from Krishna in terms of our own comfort, stability, peace of mind. And when we pray, like I was saying, at least I shamelessly pray for those things. Comfort, stability, peace of mind, health. But here, these kings are saying, our torment was your grace. We don't generally thank Krishna for things that cause us pain. But these kings are thanking Krishna. They're seeing Krishna face to face in this particular encounter. And the description of Krishna when they see him, we hear it, and in our relative comfort, stability, and peace of mind, it sounds very beautiful. How is it? They saw the Lord in yellow silks and skin of monsoon blue, his smiling face adorned with lotus eyes of pinkish hue. Imagine this. Imagine the king's situation, if you possibly can. And imagine now they're seeing Krishna. It's all over. Krishna is saving them. Their time in prison is over. And Krishna is standing right before them. So, when you see Krishna, or you experience Krishna's mercy as it is, then you're able to see everything else in perspective. Things balance out. You may think your life is really hard, really austere, really tough, just unbearable. But then you have some contact with Krishna, and Krishna gives you some mercy. And you see, oh my gosh, you feel humbled, you feel low, you feel, what was I complaining about? You can see that just the presence of Krishna in your life balances out anything that might be on the other side. That, and here it shows that Krishna really is the person who can give full satisfaction to our endlessly deep desires for happiness and relief and anything. And that this life is so short. It's practically nothing. And we attach so much importance to it. Tulsi Priya was giving class last night on the lifetime of Lord Brahma, how long that is, how many kalpas, how many ages, how many years, and how many Brahmas there are, how many universes. And all of us are thinking, boy, my life is really tough, you know. When, you know. So when you see Krishna, you experience Krishna consciousness, things get put into perspective. And then you start to see there's Krishna, and that anything that takes our consciousness away from Krishna is really regrettable. Like these kings were in prison, but apparently these kings were different from the kings that Krishna was, you know, wholesale slicing the heads, you know, all Jarasandha's people, all his recruits. Different category of kings here. These kings were all praying for Krishna to save them. They were all devotees. And so they said to him here, to rid us of illusions that attach us to this place, as childish men seek water from mirages in the sand, a fool reveres illusions that keep slipping through his hand. Forgetting you and chasing wealth, we fought without regard for anybody else. Dear Lord, your lesson has been hard. So, they understand that whatever they might have been chasing, if it was taking them away from their service attitude to Krishna, that's worse than being in prison. Because when they're in prison, they're always thinking Krishna, 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 Krishna. But when you're in the enjoying mentality, you're thinking, me, 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 me. I noticed this a little bit in my own mind when I was just spending some time in India. I was born in this country. I don't speak Hindi, Odissi, Bengali, Marathi, any Indian language. So just to get around was very, very difficult. You practically had to find a translator. In my mind, I'm thinking all these people have lifetimes of preparation to how to cheat me in various ways. And in a foreign language, I have no chance. You know, so like, Krishna, Krishna, please. I just have to go and buy some bananas. Please let me not be cheated too horribly this time. I just have to get a rickshaw down the road. Please let me not be completely cheated out of, you know. And so I was very, very prayerful. And then I come back here and I've got my car, which I can drive on the proper side of the road. I know I can read all the street signs. I can go to a very controlled environment and buy anything I need, not have to haggle for minutes and hours, you know. And you really, this country has an atmosphere that breathes the enjoying spirit, and it's so insidious that you don't want that. You want to keep the prayerful spirit, but then you come back to America and it's like, oh no, you know. But anything taking us away from Krishna is really worse than being in prison. Different examples of this come up. Like, for example, Shishupal himself, was he Nanda or Sunanda? Or Jaya Vijay? But he was one of these devotees in Vaikuntha serving the Lord, cursed by the Kumaras to come to the material world. They were given the choice. You can come X number of times as demons, 3 times, or more times as devotees, 7 times. And they did the math, and they thought, okay, 3 times, whatever gets us back to Krishna faster, we'll do. It doesn't matter, whatever. We'll be the worst demons, the most, you know, envious, evil, killer demons, whatever you want, just get us back to you. And I was thinking about this, and you look at the activities that that they perform during their lifetimes as demons, as Shishupal, Dantavakra, as Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, as Ravana, Kumbhakarna, the police blotters of all the newspapers in the world would be filled eternally with all of their, you know, atrocities. And so many people were harmed and inconvenienced and murdered and everything because of their activities. And you think, well, that's not ethical. That's not nice. Shouldn't you have just taken your birth as devotees and, you know, been nice, and you would have gone back to Krishna? While here, you would have been thinking of Krishna. You would have been devotees. No, what's the problem? Why do you have to, what's the hurry? You know, why 3 births, why do you choose this? And I was thinking that anything that takes us away from Krishna is the worst thing that can possibly happen to us. Because even if we run the risk of forgetting Krishna, That's the worst thing that can happen to any of us, because we're all Krishna's devotees. We're meant to serve Krishna all the time. And so Jai and Vijay were thinking, 3 births, 7 births, we'll take 3 births. Whatever gets us back fast, whatever you want, we'll kill everybody just so you can kill us and get us back there. And they're the biggest troublemakers the world has ever seen. We don't have much time left, but I just wanted to say a couple more things. That if we want to learn from the example of these kings, we need to adopt their mood. That, what do they say here? Our torment was your grace to rid us of illusions that attach us to this place. Very easy to get attached to this world, even though there are so many iffy things, so many nasty things. Our mind finds the nice things, and we think, oh, this place is okay. I can have a good time. And we make our plans, and we think in terms of that. When I recently visited the Radha Gopinath temple in Chaupati, the day I arrived, I had just eaten some very wrong thing the day before in Calcutta. And so my digestive, I won't give you the details, but I was lying on my back and only back and bathroom, back and bathroom, back and bathroom. That was my scenery for the first day in Chaupati. I couldn't move. I had no energy at all. So I was humble. I paid full dandavats for hours and hours and hours upon arriving there. And I felt so grateful when my health and strength started to return a little bit. And I noticed also sometimes in India they make doorways to ashrams really small, like ridiculously small, like only a pony could get in there. Like for the Bhaktivedanta Vidyapith in Govardhan, Gopi Puranadana Prabhu runs a Sanskrit school, and sweet, sweet place. Every day, the best classes you've ever heard in your life, wonderful prasadam, and the door is like this big. You have to like hunch down and crunch your legs up just to kind of get through. And I was thinking, this is for humility. You cannot enter a nice spiritual place without being humble. So I was thinking of that when I was coming to Chaupati. I was like, ugh. You know, everything was bad. But I was able to appreciate it more, I believe, because I was in a humbled condition. And humbled condition, considering our size, what is our actual size as spiritual souls? Really small. So we go around with this tremendously inflated sense of who we are and our importance, and when it becomes, you know, slapped or poked or pinched, we can't take it. But that's only the false ego. The soul cannot be what? Burned, dried, moistened, withered, cut, insulted. How can you be insulted if you think you're, you know? So what is that verse that we should be wearing as a garland around? Trinadapi sunichena, blade of grass, because blade of grass is pretty close to what we are, you know. Somebody stepping on you. Yeah, that's just the way it is, you know. More feet, please, you know. And with that state of mind, what? One can chant the holy name of the Lord constantly. And then what happens when we chant the holy name of the Lord? Anandam buddhivardhanam. Everything, all happiness is there. But not if we're like, check me out, you know. Hare Krishna. Kunti Devi. What does she say? She prays to Krishna, let all these calamities come again and again, because then what happens? Then we remember you. And what happens when we remember you? Then we realize we have no problems. Then we have no problems. Because Krishna is the big prize. When you read about these gigantic, powerful, influential warriors, Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Bhima, what happens when they see Krishna? They start crying. They start crying. And the descriptions are that they practically bathe themselves and the Lord with the tears that they are crying. These powerful, powerful warriors that we can't even imagine. But what their reaction when they see Krishna is so emotional. And what do we think when we hear that? Do we think, oh, these guys are, you know, old-fashioned, or they're just being sentimental, or what? What do we think? We think it's an exaggeration? But this is their genuine response to seeing someone so beautiful, so wonderful, so charming, so generous, so great as Krishna. They see him and they think, this is it. They don't want to see anything else. This is it. We've attained everything. So these kings are having the same reaction. They say, oh, whatever we suffered in prison is nothing. Nothing. In fact, if we have to go to prison again, it means seeing you again. Fine. Same way Kunti Devi is praying. It's worth it. They've won the lottery. Everything's good. So In our lives, we can think about these things. Think how just one little drop of Krishna conscious experience for us is worth anything we might think we have to go through, any amount of laundry or washing dishes. It's nothing. Nothing compared to having some little experience of Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.